This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
And a very warm welcome back to Solidarity Breakfast.
A left response to the major developments in capitalism.
What they trade in is not wheat. They trade in famine.
A little dose of revolutionary optimism.
I think it's really important to sort of express solidarity globally.
It really is a deal by corporations for corporations.
The union forever defending our rights, down with the black leg.
If you think the ABC's left wing, don't listen to this program.
Solidarity Breakfast, 7:30 to 9 a.m. Saturdays, 3CR, 8:55 a.m. Streaming and 3CR digital, podcast or audio on demand. And of course, the website, solidaritybreakfast.org.au.
Solidarity forever!
Good morning, everybody. This is Annie and Tobia and Anila. We're all here. How are you guys?
The whole team's here.
Pretty good. Been up since 5:30, so definitely have mush for brains, but other than that, feeling good. Excited to hear a weather report, actually.
Actually, it was funny because it was raining on the way here. Mm-hmm. You didn't probably notice it, but when I was riding, I realised that
I got very wet.
And it's been so funny because we've been having proper weather, you know, as in summer weather, and then all of a sudden it's gales out there. Like when I went out, because I live down by the sea, I went out the gate and the cat was going, I don't want to get out, because there was this noise out there like something from a science fiction novel. It was going, but it was what it was the wind scraping something along the pavement. So it was like something from one of those horror movies.
Well, very nicely timed with Halloween.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Anyway, we've got lots of Halloweenish type details in the headlines, I'll have to say, but this is real life.
It's been an interesting week. Something I've been keeping an eye on this week is Israel recently introducing a bill to introduce the death penalty for people labelled as terrorists or convicted as terrorists. So it was introduced by the National Security Committee of the Knesset, and they voted to approve an amendment that would extend the death penalty to those convicted of terrorism by Israel. That's for first reading, so it hasn't been passed yet. Despite the objection of the Knesset's legal advisers, the Knesset's website outlined that the bill proposes that a terrorist convicted of murder motivated by racism or hostility towards a particular public and under circumstances where the act was committed with the intent to harm the State of Israel and the rebirth of the Jewish people in their homeland.
Of the Jewish people in their homeland. It's not a cult.
No. Shall be sentenced to death. This is the part that I mean, all of it's obviously incredibly scary, but I think this part is particularly scary. They shall be sentenced to death mandatorily, not optionally, or at the court's discretion.
Crikes.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, I mean, it's not quite that dystopic, but in Victoria, we've seen Senator Lydia Thorpe is fighting a Senate bill at the moment, which will see the freezing of Centrelink assets for people that are under a warrant. I'll read from her media release. Punishment before trial. Thorpe calls on Senate to reject police powers buried in Social Security bill. Senator Lydia Thorpe will move an amendment to strike out Schedule 5 of the Social Security and Other Legislation Amendment Bill 2025, after the government quietly inserted a measure to expand police power into the social safety net. The bill is expected to come to a vote in the Senate this week. Schedule 5 was quickly added to the bill just days ago without scrutiny from the Human Rights or Community Affairs Committees. It allows police to advise the responsible minister to cancel a person's Centrelink payment where an arrest warrant exists against them. This would include cancellation of concession cards, pensions, job seeker, youth allowance, family tax benefit, and parental leave pay, with no requirement that the person subject to a warrant has been convicted, appeared in court, or received legal advice. Senator Thorpe's amendment to remove the schedule is in full is backed by a broad coalition of anti-poverty, disability and legal advocacy groups.
This is federal. This is not Victorian. This is federal.
Federal, sorry, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. There's a couple of other bills that are more positive that have just been passed by the Senate. The Fair Work Amendment, Baby Priya's Bill, 2025. You'll remember Chris Breen, who's known by a lot of people in the activist community down in Victoria. They moved up to the New South Wales. But anyway, he and his partner were the leading protagonists of this particular bill. It makes sure that employers pay parental leave isn't cancelled if a child is stillborn or dies shortly after birth. So that's a forward-leaning a bill, which has just been passed. But also, this is another one, Treasury Amendment, Payday Superannuation Bill 2025, a Superannuation Guarantee Charge Amendment Bill 2025, requires employers to pay super at the same time as wages instead of quarterly to help tackle the $5 billion unpaid super each year.
Well, that's great to hear. The other really positive bit of news this week is out of America. Who would have thought
a
positive headline from the US? So we've had the pretty impressive or amazing victory of, you know, self-described Democratic Socialist, Zohran Mamdani, who won the race for New York mayor this week. I thought some of the statistics around his ability to mobilize the New York kind of public are genuinely awe-inspiring. I think it's been an incredibly, inspirational and quite innovative grassroots campaign. So some interesting tidbits from the campaign. For both the primary and general elections, Mamdani reached the $8 million donation limit. So he had to stop. He had to ask people to stop donating because he maxed out his donations.
And, that's interesting, though.
Yeah, very interesting. And most of that was made up of small donations. So in the primary elections, he received donations from 180,000 donors.
This is people thirsting for proper positive change.
Yeah, totally. It's not really a mystery why it was an effective campaign. He essentially had a platform that actually did something to address people's concerns and needs, you know, as public servants,
like
as politicians are supposed
needs,
to do. Yes.
As opposed to highfalutin carry-on.
And, you know, that's reflected in the fact that he managed to attract 100,000 volunteers. Over 1 million New Yorkers ended up voting for his platform. And that platform was, you know, especially in an American context, incredibly progressive. So he committed to freezing rents for 2 million New Yorkers, public-owned supermarkets to improve the affordability of groceries, making bus travel free, and providing free childcare for children between 6 weeks to 5 years old. So that's another really positive bit of news this week.
That's really fantastic. Let's see it happening.
And that was despite Donald Trump threatening New Yorkers with a withdrawal of federal funding, and they came out anyway. So
there you go.
Yeah, people couldn't be scared away.
Yeah, that's right. It's there's the Americans have been doing something really unpleasant to the Venezuela these days. So do you want to talk
about
that?
But not only, even more than, I'll just return home 1 second while we're talking about funding, but this one being of the more nefarious kind. We've seen Chris Hedges call out the National Press Clubs for his 81 corporate sponsors on the website. I'll read from an Undue Influence article by Michelle Fahey here. The National Press Club of Australia lists 81 corporate sponsors on its website. 21 of them listed below are either part of the global arms industry or actively working on its behalf. 10 are multinational weapons manufacturers or military service corporations that include the world's two largest weapons manufacturers, Lockheed Martin and Raytheon, British giant Bae Systems, and France's largest weapons maker, Thales, and US weapons corporations, Leidos. All five are in the global top 20. Bae Systems with which is the largest contractor to the Department of Defense, receiving $2 billion from Australian taxpayers last year. This as on the weekend, we saw mass protests in Sydney.
Yep, that's
right.
Which
were largely peaceful, mm-hmm. With a carbon copy of the police commissioner that was from down here.
Did he hold a rock in his hand?
He didn't, but he said that police were forced.
Forced.
To use pepper spray.
Forced.
They had no other choice.
They had no other choice.
But to target.
And did they bring out the horses?
They did bring out the horses. They did bring out the horses, even New South Wales.
I'd go to these demonstrations, I'd go, oh no, they've brought out the horses.
Yeah, it was actually kind of remarkable how peaceful the rally was. But
well,
there are,
you know,
videos of police doing crazy, like punching protesters in the face, and other police officers are restraining the police
oh
officer.
God.
So it has to be a particularly harrowing sight to see that police are restraining themselves. But not only that, South Australia also had their defence expo, and the Australian ran a little spot on YouTube that said, oh, there's a problem in the arms industry. No one's buying enough. So says the expo. And while you can see in the background, there's ex-Minister of Defence Christopher Pine walking around.
Yeah,
there's all these little ghouls walking around behind him.
They're ghouls, aren't they? Because the reason for why there was the demonstrations, of course, was because the US government, New South Wales government, was the chief sponsor of the Sydney International Weapons Expo.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, well, yeah. You had Chris, anti-worker Chris Minns.
Yeah, yeah.
Saying that we don't want to attack the defence industry. Actually, it's one of the most critical industries going forward, and we want to see this defence industry expand in the future.
I don't think this can be separated from Donald Trump's call a couple of months ago to encourage both the EU and Australia to increase weapon spending.
Yeah, yeah, that's
right. I think it's probably worth noting that clearly that call has been responded to by the Premier, but also by industry. Like, I think that South Australia,
The defence state, yeah. That's what they call themselves.
The tagline in the ad that you're mentioning, it's scarily similar to what Donald Trump was asking for overtly, and I don't think that's a coincidence.
Oh, no, well, earlier on, in South Australia, they were actively involving weapons companies in proselytising to school children.
Mm-hmm.
And leading children into that kind of study with the outcome going into the defence industries. That was the pipeline. And it was specifically being focused on public schools.
Mm.
Well, we reported this on the Phil F. show on Wednesday about Italy is living through a current period that it resembles the fight for the historical wars that happened here with the Anzacs, where before really the Howard government, they were Anzacs and more generally World War One soldiers and stuff like that were a leftist cause. There was mass strikes, there was mass mobilizations against conscriptions, and then it was all sort of washed into this myth of the, you know, the diggers and the da-da-da, and they're rolling it into the national identity. In Italy, mm-hmm. at the moment, there's a big push. So they're ignoring the government, the fascist Meloni government is ignoring the 25th of April, which is the Liberation from Fascism Day, and instead choosing to place institutional power and resources behind the 4th of November, which is largely a military parade celebrating the importance of the military
the
and
propaganda
the importance
of
the soldier. And so this, as the equivalent to a Minister for Defence, is Crozetto, is saying that, yeah, there will be AI in the coming wars, but actually that the coming wars will be made up of mud, barbed wire and trenches. And so we need to get the 30,000 or whatever enlisted up to 90,000 standing soldiers by 2030. And this, as they've pushed a program to go into primary schools and start education like this, start a military education.
And I think we're going to talk about this in more detail next week, but I think it's worth mentioning that there's been a general kind of ramping up of rhetoric from both Russia and the US around nuclear weapons. And there's also been, across multiple different UN treaties around disarmament, there's been a withdrawal of consensus, including around things like chemical weapons, which is one of the oldest weapons treaties in UN history, in global history even. And there's clearly been a weakening of international consensus around striving for peace and striving for a world without these vastly destructive and also uncontainable weapons. And this, I think that's a trend that's rift. Definitely emerging.
This is a class rift. You know, come on, everybody, sacrifice yourself for the greater good of the corporation.
I mean, AUKUS is a great example.
I know.
Like the idea that you can convince South Australians to use their backyard as like nuclear waste disposal.
Unbelievable stuff. Oh, actually, we'll probably need to move on, but we've got so many other things to talk about. I would actually like to mention that on a very local level that it's Asbestos Awareness Week. And the reason for why I want to bring it up is because apparently, one in three Australian homes contain asbestos, and a large amount of people who actually die of
mesothelioma
are actually contracting it not at their workplace, but when they do their own DIY. Mm-hmm. So when they're doing their renovations. And so people have to be very, very careful. 4,000 Australians die annually from an asbestos-related disease, three times the 2024 national road toll. Many of them are actually related to the work that they're doing in their homes. So be very careful. Be very scared.
Very ominous.
Yeah, I know, especially.
I know, it's just that it's right there. You know, you think, oh, I'll just go and do that. I'll knock down that old shed in the backyard and I'll do, you know, something. Except, of course, it's really dangerous.
Especially like we heard in your Stick Together, in your Stick Together episode, the importance of even just looking at what the guidelines are or asking for help from someone that knows more, whether it's at work, it's your HSR, your shop steward, your whatever. Or it's at home and you ask someone that knows maybe a bit more than you. Keep yourself safe because it's not worth dying for.
Okay, there you go. We're going to move on.
It's the government's job to protect Australia's forests and oceans. But too often, governments put the interests of big corporations ahead of protecting your health, your climate and your children's future. The Albanese government is about to change Australia's nature law. While this might seem like telling them how to suck eggs, we expect laws that actually protect nature by closing deforestation loopholes and protecting threatened species. It's literally their job. Head to wilderness.org.au/suckeggs to learn more. The Wilderness Society is a 3CR supporter.
This week for Voices for Palestine. We're going to go to two different events, very different in time, but about the same theme. I went to the Eco-Socialism Conference, and there was a session, which is what a fantastic title. We'd be killed in Israel as terrorists just by saying this. Listen to this. The session was called "Does Israel Have a Right to Exist?" That was the name of the session. But this is actually Youssef Al-Remari, who is the leading light of Palestine Remembered, which is on later in the morning on 3CR. He was talking about the importance of poetry in the era of genocide. So let's hear what he had to say.
Okay, thanks. Yusuf is going to tell us a 3-minute short story to finish up.
Yes, thank you. I wanted to talk about the role of arts in times of darkness. I myself have a humble experience in music and creative writing in Arabic language, And it makes me think of, you know, why Palestinians in Gaza think of poets now. There was an academic, Riyad Mansour, in Gaza, who wrote in Arabic on Facebook the 6 or 7 months of the genocide, saying, "Where are you, Mahmoud Darwish? Why don't we have another Darwish?" Darwish is a Palestinian poet who lived from early 40s until 2008, and who gave Palestine a voice on, and he took us to higher skies. In times of darkness and genocide, and the more you rationalize with your reality, the more your hearts and minds and souls feel like they're gonna fall apart. The more you need satire and theater and dancing and music and black comedy and poetry and dancing and any form of art. And that is something that not just Palestinians have resorted to, but also civilizations since the beginning of dawn, whether the disaster or calamity or darkness or hardship is because of a natural disaster like the flood or war, the immediate response, by the, even before the dust settles, is a black comedy joke, is something like a song or a poem or something where maybe a hymn or a lullaby that, you know, puts you to protect your soul. And Darwish, again, I'm referring to Darwish, was in Beirut in 1971. And he was 29. And it was his first time in Lebanon. And it was his second year out after he had left the so-called Israel. First to Egypt and then to Lebanon. He was known to a few writers in the scene, but he's used to going unnoticed wherever he goes. And then he attended in Beirut, in one of the churches, a contest or a competition of poetry for young poets. And he was taken to this local event by a local Lebanese / Syrian poet called Adonis. And not expected to be known, the nun, or just one of the workers of the church that organizes the poetry contest, when she heard him introduce himself as Mahmoud Darwish, she immediately said, "Mahmoud Darwish, the Palestinian?" He said, "Yes." And she said, "I've been looking for you for 4 years." Imagine somebody says that to you, "I've been looking for you for 4 years. I needed to talk to you after this ends." And then she said, "I was in Jerusalem in 1967 during the Six-Day War when Israel invaded and occupied Jerusalem and Gaza and West Bank and Golan Heights and Sinai. And my role from a Levantine church happens to be in Jerusalem church to provide services, sometimes in Jerusalem, Damascus, Beirut, but I happen to be in Jerusalem when the war broke out." She's Lebanese. And she said, "During the war, my tasks or my duties became to accompany the severely injured Palestinians who have no hope of recovery, terminal, so that they don't die alone. So anyone in hospital that has no relatives next to his or her bed, we were delegated to be next to them so that they don't die alone. And I happened to be sent next to the bed of a young Palestinian boy or young man from Jerusalem, and it's a very hard situation to accompany and to comfort somebody who has a few hours or a few minutes or even a few days to live." And she said, "Can I bring you anything? Can I bring you chocolate, drinks, cigarettes, anything?" And he said, "Can you go to the old city and you go to a bookstore? There is a book called by a random person, Ahmed Darwish, Muhammad Darwish, Mahmoud Darwish, I'm not sure. It's called Birds with No Wings. Bring me that book and come back." So she had no idea what the book was about and the poet, and she found it and came back. And it was one of his earliest collection of poetry, that poet. It's called Tuyur Bila Ajniha, Birds with No Wings. And it describes what it means to be stateless on your own land. And that young Palestinian man said, read until I die. Read until I die. That is the role of poetry in times of heart. And by poetry, I mean music and any form of art. And that is what we need to remember when we are busy talking about political and discussion, which is important and must continue. But we have to also remember storytelling and art and poetry. Because like they say, poetry, that's not my quote I'm referring, poetry heals the wounds inflicted by reason. Poetry heals the wounds inflicted by reason. Shukran.
Attitude to the importance of art and writing and other elements that are important to Palestinian people and people in general. I went to a reading from a conversation with the writer Michaela Saha and her about her book Find Me at the Jaffa Gate. During the summer season, we'll probably play more of that particular conversation that she was having. This is the reading that she gave. It was called Revenge. You had something to say, Tabia.
Yeah, we can also do it at the end, but there's been some good news in that the Department of Defense has finally instructed the Australian defense manufacturers to stop exporting weapons directly to Israel, with 37 of the 66 permits that were issued requiring no further action. So some good news there.
And also it's Palestine National Day.
It is Palestine National Day today. So if you have some time, go down to Federation Square from 2 till 10. There's a whole program. You can practice your dabke. You can get some music. They'll bring some food. Get down.
Now for Michaela.
So this chapter is actually my father's favourite chapter. I think it's because it's a chapter about something we did together and not about the past, but something that was a more sort of contemporary experience. And the other thing I'd now like to say about this chapter, which I've never said before, is in an earlier draft, I mentioned a young man who used to be an ABC radio presenter called Jesse Cox. And Jesse Cox's great aunt was a woman called Janet Van Brown, who you may know of, and if you don't, she's worth knowing about. And her partner was a guy called Wael Zawaita, who was a Palestinian intellectual and writer, and he was the first of the Palestinian intellectuals and artists and writers to be assassinated by Mossad in the 1970s. And Jesse made a beautiful theatrical production about it, which in an earlier iteration of this chapter I've written into the book. Revenge. Revenge is a very satisfying word I have found in moments of anger, which comforts me, although I have few causes in which to use it. Revenge is a word that lingers on the palate. You try it. Revenge, that springy sound with some grip to it. Revenge, which does not do the work of its meaning half so often as the production of the word does a work of satisfaction, stamping its way around my mouth. I do not often think of the word before 2018. And since 2018, when I think of revenge, I think of a poem with this name by Taha Muhammad Ali, which when I first hear it conveys to me an apotheosis of the Palestinian condition. Revenge is one fantasy among the many fantasies we Palestinians harbor, wielding our title deeds and brandishing our keys. And I long for the house that my pa built and in which, like his business, he gave a share to each of his brothers. I write it in the four names, as Pa says on the tape. All these proofs of our lives in a place we are told has never existed, and that we are told is a place in which we have never existed either. So I go to a play about Taha, and I go with my father and the love of my life, who I wait a long time to meet, and who waits even longer to meet me. And Dad is enlivened by the sight of the Palestinian community who have turned out to see this work at the Art Centre Melbourne's Big World Up Close season. And I have to ask Dad not to point when he recognises faces. The handsome Palestinian and the curly-haired one, friends whose names I'm not sure he knows or remembers. The poem begins, "At times I wish I could meet in a duel the man who killed my father and raised our home, expelling me into a narrow country." This is a poem by a man, and maybe revenge is a masculine fantasy. And if he killed me, I'd rest at last, and if I were ready, I would take my revenge. This first verse nurtures something in my heart and in all the hearts of the audience at Taha who are Palestinian. Yes, we think, yes, we are here, and you will not deny it when we take our revenge. In the first verse of this poem, all our bloody fantasies are recognized, because you cannot negate the existence of hands that seek to annihilate. Until I hear this verse, I do not think I have harbored such violence inside me, but it feels good to hear it, springy words stamping about. And it feels also like another great apprehension of that elusive catharsis. I wonder how this play is received around the world as it is toured and performed. And I remember a footnote I read once about Elia Suleiman's Divine Intervention. A motif in that film is a red balloon printed with a caricature image of Yasser Arafat. And at its first screening in Ramallah, the Palestinians cheer and throw up their arms as the balloon swoops over Kalandia checkpoint and soars high to the gold glittering dome of the Rock in Jerusalem, marking a flight path unthinkable to a Palestinian audience in Ramallah with inferior West Bank permits issued them. But the poem does not finish there, and our poet has cause next to reflect on the victim of his fantasy, the victim who has victimized him. And he says, "But if it came to light, when my rival appeared, that he had a mother waiting for him." And here Taha wends his way through all the caveats that depict the value of a life, even a violent one, to the people who love him. Here I return to the measured teaching of what it means to be a Palestinian, and to a day around a month before I submit my doctoral thesis. My supervisor and I sitting outside at a cafe on a windy day, and he is hearing impaired and cannot hear me over the wind, and I am clutching hundreds of pages of an unbound manuscript, trying to take notes and restrain these loose papers. And he says, "You know, the hatred of the colonized is neither equal nor opposite to the hate of the colonizer." And although I do not know of a study on this, I know he is right. And I think also to the other great lesson he imparts to me some years earlier, when we are sitting outside again and we are combing through a draft of a chapter, and he says, "Don't be an angry Palestinian, be a clever one." And Taha finishes his verse, "Then I would not kill him, even if I could." Revenge is a fantasy with mercurial properties, and as Taha describes it, a word which is satisfying to repeat again, and I entreat you to do it, he also cuts into it, like the genealogical dating that is done on all the layers of silt on the side of a cliff. And as I listen, I return to fantasies enshrined by Anne-Marie Jasser in The Salt of the Sea, a film that encapsulates all the fantasies of the diaspora of people like me. In that film, we watch the protagonist, Soraya, do all the things that we dream of doing. Here she comes from America with her papers and memories, and first she says she is from there, and she argues with the Palestinian Authority, "You don't get to say with a piece of paper whether I am or am not Palestinian." And then she goes to the bank with a ledger of savings, and she says she would like to withdraw this balance. And they take her into a room, and they tell her she can't, and she says, "Well, the bank is still here." In Yaffa, she visits the house that her grandfather built, laying the stones and afterwards the tiles inside it. And the woman who lives there invites her in, but Soraya won't leave, and the Jewess says, "What do you want?" And Soraya is full of rage and she shouts, "What I want is my house. Yes, this is the woman I wish I was when I stand at the border between Jordan and Palestine and I tell the Israelis that I am Australian and I tell them that my father is after all born in Amman and I wish I could say, you know, and I know that I am from here, but I never do say this." In the final verse, Taha reflects on what he would do if the subject of his revenge was in no way connected to the life of another, and it begins, "But if he turned out to be on his own, cut off like a branch from a tree." And the play has been building to this great recitation, and then the final phrase, "Instead, I'd be content to ignore him when I passed him by on the street, as I convinced myself that paying him no attention in itself was a kind of revenge." And what Taha does best is to explain us to ourselves, and in this luminous line, to convey also for the international audiences our staggering gentleness in the face of a moment in which we might take our revenge and do not, and the staggering humility of the gentle Palestinian who defers this satisfaction, whose dream they have tended for a lifetime, and walks away. At the end of Taha, the audience sits stunned for a moment before this too breaks, and they collect their coats and personal items, and one audience member is heard to say, "Quite something to hear the story of a Nakba survivor." And my dad is still seated, but then he stands and turns to me and he says, "That's me. I'm an Nakba survivor." But the crowds have drifted away and my father grows smaller and smaller in the emptying theatre. And now there is no one to hear him but me.
Eyes are red, but you're high and I'm crying. You're trying to forget, but it hits me every time. You pray next to me, your right hand holds your left sleeve, turning our heads gently, cause when it ends we fight. And in that warm winter I withered, I just wanna get better. I'll be what you like. Makes me wanna cry. Whose Lord are you naming when you start to break things? It's my only life you hold. And when you left me waiting, I thought, did you do it in the name of God? Already done, and I walk to the nearest door. just to see someone. Everything is black, your hands on my past. If I don't wait tomorrow, promise me you'll laugh. And in that warm winter, I withered. I just wanna get better. I'll be what you like. And every letter of fire you read me when I'm tired. Treat pain as a choir. Whose Lord are you naming when you start to break things? It's my only life you hold. And when you left me waiting, I thought, did you do it in the name of God?
وانت؟
انا؟
ايوه
انا.
انت بقى حاجة سبحان الله.
انا انسان مسلم.
انسان ومسلم.
Oh, what a lovely song.
Yeah, that was Name of God by Canadian Sudanese or Sudanese Canadian musician.
Yeah, Mustafa. Musician. And we've got on the line Rodrigo Acuna. G'day, Rodrigo. How are you?
Not too bad.
Yeah, yeah. Now, the reason why we've got you here is because you have made a film called Venezuela, The Cost of Challenging an Empire. And I must say, it is a perfect time for such a film to be screening on December the 6th for the local audience. Can you tell us your journey for making this film?
Oh, I've been travelling to Venezuela for many years now. I've got a PhD on the subject of Venezuelan foreign policy. And I've travelled to the country several times, and so many of the things that I've seen, I've always wanted to capture on camera, not just write about them in academic articles or media articles, but also actually capture them on film. So I teamed up together with a journalist called Nicholas Ford, and I put forward the idea of putting together a small independent film, and he agreed, and we managed to get to Venezuela and do filming for about 3 weeks, maybe a month we were there in 2021. And then when we came back to Australia, we proceeded to edit all of the footage. And 2 years and 8 months later, we had a small documentary, which we presented last year at the New South Wales Teachers Federation and a few other places here in Sydney and in Brisbane. And we've been trying to get the film to Melbourne for a while now. But all sorts of things have happened. But we are now going to present the film in Melbourne on the 6th of December at the Wildflower Picture House and Bar in Fitzroy North. So
it's actually a very nice little venue, I'll have to say. I've been there before and it's very comfortable.
We've been talking a bit on the show about the importance of writing and poetry and artistic expression as a part of, the kind of Palestinian experience. Could you talk a bit about why, for you, film as a medium has been such an important part of telling this story, as you just said, above and beyond, for instance, academic publications?
I think there's a situation with visual imagery that people find much more believable, or it has an impact on them. And although I don't, I'm not a filmmaker, I haven't been doing this for a long time, I certainly do understand how people perceive information. information and how to put that information mm-hmm. together. And I can tell you that the majority of mainstream media coverage on Venezuela has often, for a very long time, been highly inaccurate, highly inaccurate. There was recently a report on 60 Minutes USA on Venezuela and presented the country in a sort of standard way that it's a repressive regime. People are just waiting for a U.S. invasion or some sort of U.S. attack to overthrow the government. And the situation is actually much more complex on the ground. The government for a very long time has had easily about 50%, maybe, statistics vary depending on the elections. Sometimes it's about 40, sometimes it's about 50%. But there's a noticeable percentage of the population which has long supported its political programs and its projects. And to just simply ignore them is just unacceptable in my view. And there's also the situation of the violence. If you have a look at who has perpetrated the majority of the violence in the last 20 or so years in the country or pushed for a political crisis to take place, when you break down the actual figures of the victims, the majority have always come from the political right, the ones that are pushing for the violence. And the people that are actually experiencing the violence and having family members killed are just poor working-class Venezuelans, often Afro-Venezuelans. And because they don't have access to the mainstream media, because they don't have access to CNN in Spanish, they're often ignored. So that's what I tried to do in my documentary, is tell some of their stories as well. And I interviewed two mothers, and their stories are actually quite powerful, quite moving.
As you've kind of just mentioned, there's obviously a big difference between how a lot of these things are discussed, particularly in American contexts and media, compared to experiences on the ground in Venezuela. And as we were preparing for this interview, I was having a look at some of the academic coverage of sanctions in Venezuela, and a lot of the American analysis emphasizes sanctions as a diplomatic approach to political change. And I've got a quote from a Georgetown Journal of International Affairs article that describes the intention of sanctions but exemptions for resource access for companies like Chevron, as intended as diplomatic tools to promote, quote, diplomatic reforms. So there's a lot of framing of sanctions and access for specific US and foreign companies as diplomatic and democratic. Can you talk to us a little bit about how you feel that compares to what you're observing on the ground?
Well, it's that's a nice language to utilize, which is going to promote US foreign policy. But the reality is, one, the US has long done this towards Latin American countries or governments that have defied its interest in the region. They've long used economic sanctions to hurt and to put pressure on governments. They did that with the Allende government in Chile in the 1970s. They did that with the Sandinista government in the 1980s in Nicaragua. And the other thing is that the sanctions actually just hurt average people. That's who they actually hurt. So take, for example, medicines for people that have diabetes. A lot of people in Venezuela have actually died because they can't get access to insulin because of U.S. economic sanctions. So that is something that is not discussed in the mainstream media. And the number of Venezuelans that have died, totally unnecessarily, it's into the thousands. It's absolutely appalling that they should be struggling to purchase medications on the international markets because of the sanctions that the U.S. government has imposed on.
Well, it's this also this really cynical kind of like we care for the Venezuelan people, but not enough to care about what the cost of actual sanctions are, which are well documented, right from Iraq onwards. I'm sort of interested on I'm really interested to see the movie when it gets here, but also what the feeling is like in Venezuela towards US foreign policy. Like, are people preparing, people are ready to for an eventual confrontation, or what's the feeling on the ground?
Well, the people that I've spoken to in Venezuela from here in Australia, they are certainly preparing for a confrontation. And there's I published an article in a magazine called Truth Out in the US only a couple of days ago, maybe a week ago, and I noted that the Chavistas, the pro-government supporters, they're going to fight very, very hard. So while the United States, the Trump administration, if it does decide to carry out a full military strike to decapitate the Maduro government, while they may be able to achieve that in a couple of days or a couple of weeks, once they have to put boots on the ground, and they will have to put boots on the ground, because unless they are able to get a section of the Venezuelan military to carry out a coup against the government, they are going to have to put boots on the ground. Once that occurs, they're still going to be faced with a situation of a significant section of the population which still supports the government. And they know what is going to happen to them. They know that once their government is overthrown, a very bloody US-backed dictatorship is going to have to be imposed. So a lot of people are preparing for a fight, and a lot of people are obviously scared, they're worried, they're anxious. A lot of things on the ground are still continuing as normal. So there were some images coming out of a baseball game, and people were just, you know, going to a baseball game. Inflation hasn't skyrocketed. The economy's actually been doing well for the last 17 quarters, and they've managed to resolve a lot of problems that were systemic to just the Venezuelan economic model for decades. And I think that's also something that the United States has never, ever wanted to see a progressive government achieve in Latin America, is to actually have economic success. They can have, some level of political success, but when they start having economic success, that's always going to be a problem for U.S. interests, because then other Latin American countries and lower working class people are going to look towards their government and say, well, why can't we have similar policies in our country? Why can't we have a government like the one in Venezuela, which has built, the numbers are just absolutely amazing. And even if you sort of half them, the government has claimed it's built, I think, something like 2.5 or 3 million homes in the last 20 years. And you can see that when you travel to Venezuela, you will see government programs where houses and apartment blocks are being built for working class Venezuelans to move into large government housing project. You can see schools being built, you can see hospitals being built. And again, this is just all generally in the mainstream media, with a few honourable exceptions, it's always generally ignored.
It's funny because on my way here to the station, for some reason or other, I kept thinking about this term hierarchy of greed. And then I realised it's actually supposed to be the hierarchy of need. But it's a Maslow's theory of hierarchy of need. But in actual fact, it's a hierarchy of greed that the Americans are spitting out towards the Venezuelans. But also, even the passing on of the so-called Peace Prize to the right-wing
Machado.
We're experiencing the upper echelons propaganda mechanisms at high speed, aren't we, in relation to Venezuela?
Of course. I mean, that the handing out of the Peace Prize was just absolutely disgusting. If you take into consideration the fact that Rigoberta Menchú, an indigenous woman from Guatemala in the early 1990s, I think, received the Nobel Peace Prize, and to my knowledge, she was the only one that received the Nobel Peace Prize. I mean, that in itself is disgusting, considering the large number of horrific, absolutely brutal US-backed dictatorships that took place in the region and the number of women that, you know, with enormous amount of courage fought against them, to only recognize one woman, that in itself is something I sharply disagree with. But then to come along and award the prize to a woman who participated, a politician who participated in the 2002 coup against President Chavez, who was himself kidnapped, a person who has received millions of dollars from US funding, a person who is clearly putting the interests of her own small elite economic class and the interest of US multinationals ahead of her entire population is revolting, because the consequences of a full-scale US military attack are going to be horrific upon the Venezuelan people. There are going to be tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people that are going to die unnecessarily. So to award her such a prize is just disgusting.
Yeah, you're not wrong. You wanted to say something, Anila?
Well, I think for me, something else I'd really be interested to hear about is how, for you, this fits into America's broader foreign policy goals. The film, obviously, is called The Cost of Challenging an Empire, so I'd love to hear a little bit more about how, particularly sanctions, but obviously the escalations in the region recently are not an isolated incident. It's part of a broader kind of project of empire. And before I shut up and let you talk, I thought it would be really worthwhile to mention that there's been a study from the Lancet journal this year that's reported that US and EU sanctions have killed 38 million people since 1970. So,
oh my God.
Yeah, the stakes are high. Sanctions are not, they're not diplomacy, they're violent. Anyway, go on.
Well, that's right. I mean, and again, the objective is to overthrow a government that is not following the Washington consensus. And in Latin America, we have a long history and a long understanding of that. Economic sanctions were placed on the Allende government in the 1970s, early 1970s, with the objective of having the population turn against the government. And that's just, has been the same situation with Cuba. Cuba's been heavily sanctioned for over 60 years now. And we have US government officials saying explicitly that the objective is there's no food on the supermarkets, and that people will eventually turn on their government. And the same has been the objective with Venezuela. The difference is that because Venezuela has oil, and because we are living in a post-Cold War world where Venezuela can negotiate deals with China, with Russia, with Iran, with Turkey, they've been able to survive and at times even prosper. But the sanctions have had an enormous cost, that they are violent, and that they have the sole intention of, having people rise up against their own government. That's quite clear, and it's a story that has unfortunately repeated itself again and again. I say at the beginning of the film, this is the old story of the United States and local elites being completely incapable of coming to terms with having a progressive government in power.
Well, we remind people that Venezuela, The Cost of Challenging an Empire, is going to be shown at 318 St. George's Road, Fitzroy. It's called the Wildflower Picture House. It's just up near Peter Monty's, in fact, if you know the area. So 318 St. George's Road, and it's going to be on 6 p.m. on Saturday, December the 6th. It costs $20 or $15 concession, and the funds go to the film production costs. And more strength to your arm, Rodrigo. Thank you very much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
2,500 miles away from the American border, there's a boat humming along with 100 miles worth of gas. It's got some fishermen out there in it. Little do they know, but here in America, will be sunk down to the bottom and dead from an American blast. Now our infallible intelligence knows a whole lot about them. See, these are narco-terrorists with drugs strapped to their back. Now it's the same intelligence that had the perfect wisdom and the real good sense to know there's weapons of mass destruction hidden in Iraq. Well, if your leader is a fugitive of American justice, and if your people need liberating from their own soil, if you're a threat to our national security, well, we're probably just in need of your oil. How much fentanyl does Venezuela make? Well, Johnny, that's about 0%. See, the precursors are shipped from China into Mexico. They mix them in a lab, then they press them into pills and ship them up to Uncle Sam. Oh, well then, how much cocaine does Venezuela make? Well, Johnny, that's another goose egg too. But don't you worry, little head, because they're all just going to be like dead. Some call it murder, some call it justice. You can call it whatever you like. Dry your liberal tears, cause you know around here we call it a presidentially authorized lethal kinetic strike. Well, if it smells like Al-Qaeda and looks like ISIS, you're staring down the barrel at a refugee crisis. Well, they can dangle the Nobel carrot out in front of the mule, but I guess it wasn't orange enough to really pull the cart. Pete and Marco, come out of the closet and say you're coming on in for that oil deposit. The only war you'll ever end is the one you start.
A weak solidarity, Bricky Team Listener, when we were subject to yet another episode of Nat Zero Intelligence, as the Hayseed and Sheepshit Party decided fossil profit trumps, pun only slightly intended, Mother Earth's survival, reinforcing for the coalition the very policies that have seen it slide into electoral oblivion, which is where the Nat Zero Intelligence bit comes in. Slow, slow, slow learners failing to adopt the socialist commitment to address climate change, if there is such a thing, by announcing that commitment and practicing fossil business as usual. The bipartisan commitment to fossil profit reflected beautifully by our old mate Meg O'Neill before Profits of Woodside with Profits, whose dedicated crusade for the transition from fossils is legend. Aware we must have fossils to transition from. Meg announcing Thursday, investors, that is the people who really matter, as the bipartisan commitment knows, investors recognize that demand from data centers and AI means there is plenty of money to be made from fossil fuels for years. Whoopee, then telling us the exciting news of Woodside with plans for oil and gas all over the world for all those years. My word, Meg is certainly throwing herself into the transition, isn't she? And what a bonus. There's plenty of money to be made in the transition from a livable planet to a dead one. And those wise investors can make even more money thanks to the giant mind of Hayseed and Sheepshit Party brackets temporary genius Barnacle, informing us how power prices can drop by 25%. And all we have to do is forget all this costly renewable energy rubbish and go coal, 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 including replacing retired coal-fired power stations with new coal-fired power stations. Barnacle's wisdom emanates from a report commissioned by the Hayseed and Sheepshit Party. Experts, according to the ever-reliable Lord Rupert of Wapping Sin, a conservative right-wing consultancy, according to the Troubler Aussie Capitalist Review. Now, which of those do we believe, listener? But I have to make a confession. Barnacle did say something with which, maybe for the first time ever, I, and I suspect we, would have to agree 100%. Bringing coal back would have some detractors, he admitted. Well, yes, Barnacle, it probably would, like millions and millions and millions of people have some detractors. In the Wapping Sin article praising Barnacle's and the Hayseed and Sheepshit lot's perspicacity, coal, 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 there was not one mention of the slight impacts all that might have on the environment. And it probably won't, for as AI moves to create more and more and more and more pollution and drain Mother Earth's precious water resources, sometime climate advocate and tech filthiest rich of the filthy rich, Bill gets richer and richer,
Billy Goat, has changed tack and now says we should stop carrying on about climate change and its consequences and concentrate on helping the world's poor. What a caring man. And so congruous, so apt, particularly for, as our caring government likes to call them, our Pacific family, the climate innocents across the Pacific. Bill could provide them with lots of snorkels and aqua lungs and scuba gear so they could survive at the bottom of the piney. And Bill can go on getting richer and richer from AI. Win-win. Bill's conversion, nothing to do with his massive investment in AI and data centres, is down to realising climate change, if there is, will not lead to humanity's demise. People will be able to live and thrive in most places on Earth for the foreseeable future. Foreseeable future, Bill. Yes, as far future as 2026, for instance. Anyway, thanks to caring business class party supremo and would-be big supremo, Suss and Lees and Dregs, and shadowy Minister Angie the Bell Tolsvoor, we know saving the environment is contentious, as they pleaded with the Minister for Woodside with Murray Swatch the Environment to split his environment bill, pass the bits that speed up pollution approvals and, sometime later, discuss the more contentious issues like saving Mother Earth. While Western Troubler was his supremo, Roger Cook the Planet and the Fossils, caring business class generally, have expressed reservations about aspects of the bill, despite Murray and Anthony already doing Roger and his Fossils bidding. For instance, the minister having the power to overrule a project approval if there were, quote, unacceptable consequences, like, say, blowing up Juukan Gorge or destroying thousands and thousands of years of terra nullius non-land, non-people rock art. Oh, but hang on, that's already been approved. This outrageous clause would have unacceptable consequences for us, Roger and the Fossils chorused. Yet, given the bill is designed to placate the polluters, make life easier for Woodside with Et al., Murray says to gain the support of Sussan and Angie and Roger and the Fossils, he is prepared to dilute its impacts. The mind boggles. Murray, we ask Murray, why is a bill to protect the environment in fact protecting the polluters? Why is pollution industry policy wrapped up as environment protection? Well, clearly, the great resource polluters are an integral part of the economic environment. And, of course, environment pollution protection is why Anthony put me here. To do a job. To do my job. True listener, last week on City Limits, we interviewed Raylene Cooper, Indigenous campaigner fighting to save the Barra Peninsula rock art from Woodside with Murray, Roger and the other big polluters, who had toured the sacred sites with Murray and, how's this for disrespect, said, he doesn't know anything. How cruel. Just as cruel, but sadly it's what we've come to expect from the evil unions. The ACTU called for a 25% tax on all liquefied natural gas exports, the very lifeblood of Woodside with Et al. Profits, claiming the public purse collected 43 cents in tax on every $100 of gas exported. Okay, it doesn't sound much, but the evil unions ignore that with the massive levels of gas we're exporting as part of the transition from gas, those 43 cents add up. The ACTU selfishly reckons its 25% flat tax would raise $17 billion a year for housing, without a thought for the resource behemoth shareholders. Top marks, as usual, to the Lord Rupert of Wapping Sin for its public interest journalism fighting for us all yet again. As long as we're all good, loyal, white, Troubler Aussies. Exclusive. ER race divide screaming across P1. Would we believe it? St. Vincent's Emergency has a policy to treat Indigenous patients within 30 minutes. Racist, screams Lord Rupert, who wouldn't have a racist bone in, whose empire wouldn't have a skerrick of racism in its DNA. Forget that St. V said research showed Indigenous patients had been waiting longer than non-Indigenous, but were more likely to remain engaged with care if seen within the first hour. Not letting the bone go, our favourite flogger of balance and objectivity, next day had experts he dredged up warning the policy breached the Medical Code of Ethics and the Geneva Convention, showing how illegitimate it is to treat Telenilius non-land, non-people. And its hysterically funny cartoonist, Mark Not Funny, had a, as usual, side-splitting cartoon showing every patient in the waiting room waving the non-land, non-people flag and wearing Telenilius T-shirts. He's so clever, isn't he? But as well as that P1 exclusive, Lord Rupert did himself even prouder, informing us of yet another social injustice. Bad influence on housing. Senator slams think tank for inviting pro-squatter activists to panel. Good grief. Thank goodness for the caring business classes, media ubiquitous James Potbevall's son, for alerting us to this one. Jordan Bandenlam was speaking on a housing panel at Parliament House, organised by the True Blue Aussie Institute, a comic front as we know. Yet 6 months ago, we had released the addresses of empty houses and encouraged squatters to move in. Shame, Jordan, shame. Prompting Big Supremo Anthony to call it a disgrace, reprehensible. How dare homeless people be encouraged to occupy empty properties? And you're probably not aware that Anthony himself was raised in public housing by a single mum, so he knows about these things. And James said allowing Jordan to speak was especially irresponsible and reckless, urging the Senate to revoke his access to Parliament. Parliament's no place for those who want to house people. What the whopping Sin and James didn't mention, and it compounds the disgrace, reprehensible, irresponsible, reckless, was that Jordan, of course, ran for the Senate as a socialist. Imagine if poor James had found himself sharing the same chamber with irresponsible reckless. So another big week for Lord Rupert, but a bad week for US of the UN, of the US of the world, big supremo Donald Trump or the poor, as the ignorant, horrible, evil people of New York elected a communist. A communist, an evil communist, as mayor. Worst evil communist ever, ever. Worse, an Islamic terrorist communist, although Donald, rational Donald, may take some solace that the evil Islamic terrorist communist had already begun to water down some of his policies even before he was elected. On one of the eight wars Donald has resolved, the slaughter, destruction, genocide and starvation of the non-land, non-people, the good news this week for the non-land, non-people, apart from Zion still being forced to slaughter, destroy, genocide and starve them, was summed up in one headline. We'll call the shots in Gaza, says Zion. And did the lovers of liberty, freedom and democracy, like, say, True Blue Aussie, bother to ask what right it has to occupy Gaza, let alone call the shots? No need to answer that. In another example of the benefits for the poorest of the poor of a socialist government, the state socialists plan to increase by 70% the penalties for unpaid fines, a wonderful contribution to poverty. Yet the usual goody-goodies carried on in a Melbourne community legal complaining, for instance, it is a tone-deaf cash grab in the middle of a cost-of-living crisis, impacting vulnerable people in a disproportionate way. Where would that come from? What about respect for the law? We did seek some sensible opinions from the really important people socialising in the sundry corporate marquees at Flemington, but they were too busy whining and dining to express their compassion for the poorest of the poor. Finally, we've talked a lot about climate change today, if there is, and as COP30 assembles in the ever-decreasing Amazon rainforest, the main culprits have agreed to compromise and dilute their saving the planet targets, and that's before it's even started. What hope, Mother Earth? Good morning.
Good morning, Kevin. And you're back with Annie and Tobias and Anila on Solidarity Breakfast. And we're cruising to the end of the program. And before we do, we're going to hear from Daryl Croke. I spoke to him about an upcoming rally that's happening, protesting the delay in funding of $2.4 billion, I repeat, $2.4 billion for public schools in Victoria. This rally is going to be at Anthony Carbine MP's office, 149 Burgundy Street in Heidelberg at 4:30 p.m. on Wednesday, after school. And this is what Daryl Croak had to say about why it's so important for all of us to be there. Daryl, you're a AEU regional representative. Can you tell my listeners a little bit about what that entails for you?
Yeah, so I'm a rank and file member of the AEU. I'm the sub-branch president of my school. So that's like a union rep or a union delegate or old school shop steward. And I'm the president of the Broadmeadows region. So we cover schools from Pasca Vale all the way up to up north, all the way up to Mount Ridley, North Craigieburn. So that's so we have meetings a couple of times a term. I'm speaking today in a personal capacity, and I want to exercise my right to advocate for better funding arrangements and my community and better working conditions as a member of the AEU.
Because the slow distribution by the government of public funds for public schools has had a detrimental effect on your working life, hasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. So basically, just to make it really clear, so there was an arrangement called Gonski, which promised, so Gonski said, if you give X amount of dollars, this is what it would take to get every student up to a minimum standard of literacy and numeracy. Now, that promise was made to us. There's been a delay.
That was about a decade ago, wasn't it?
That was a decade ago. So we're $2.4 billion delay. And what that significantly means that for in Victoria, every student in Victoria receives about $1,300 less than students in public schools in other territories, states. So what this means is that we've got our class sizes could be smaller. We could be actually having more hours, less face-to-face hours. So we'd be having more hours to actually prepare work for students, and we'd be having more hours actually, to actually assess students. So at the moment, each teacher in Victoria on average is probably working at least 10 hours unpaid overtime. And we've got principals are probably in excess of 20 hours unpaid overtime.
And, of course, it's been pointed out that the students, they can't wait for this money, can they?
No, they can't. So, look, what that money pans out to be, this is affecting the most disadvantaged students disproportionately. So there's a very strong correlation between results and economic background. So we really need money going into the public system, the money to help working class kids and kids in regional areas. So they're not getting the literacy support or the numeracy support they need. In fact, it gets worse. There's a program was put in place called the TLI program, the Tutor Learning Initiative. It was brought in COVID to help those kids that were falling through the gaps. The government's just slashed that. So it's not just a matter of them cutting not coming through the promise they made a decade ago, but they've actually been cutting funding for crucial programs. In my school, we're facing a funding shortfall of $360,000. That's really designed to help the most disadvantaged kids.
Public schools have been separated from each other in a way because they're supposed to be running as sort of almost autonomous businesses, right?
Yeah, no. Look, we get so much money from the government for funding, and there's a set of figures to do that. Now, they do run autonomously. There's a degree of separation there, but funnily enough, we all suffer the same cuts. So
yeah, right.
It's not as if our school has the capacity to go out and raise funds from the community,
or that it should.
Yeah, or that it should as well, and you have to understand as well is because of the government's strategy with a whole series of things that it's making it hard. So what, you know, we see this every day. It means that we're under a lot of stress, and it means we're doing a good job in our school, and we're doing a good job in all public schools, that we just can't help the kids that we need to be helping in the way that we need to help them. It's the frustrating thing.
Yeah, well, it must be really frustrating. And also, I was wondering, are all the spots for teachers being filled? Are there any gaps?
Oh, look, there's huge gaps. And the more economically deprived, or the further you get out from Melbourne, the harder it is to fill staff. So we have had a lot of missed classes. we've had situations where students have been sent home in my region. We've had situations where students have been supervised in the gym. We've had teachers who are effectively working over allotment, so you're only supposed to work 18.5 hours face-to-face. We've had teachers working over that because the choice is we either send kids home. So it's we do have a big teacher shortfall. We've also got a lot of teachers working way out of field. So, for instance, you might be an English teacher, you might end up having to teach maths or something very, very specialised. So there is a huge teacher shortage at the moment because of the conditions we're facing, because of the pay that we're facing as well.
What you're hoping to do is that your employer, the public service, the government, will actually start loosening the purse strings and let some of that money flow through that it's been promised.
Yeah, look, a couple of things need to happen. Like the AU federally have put out a plan, you know, outlined a fairly detailed plan about how to boost our conditions to actually attract more teachers. So it's about keeping the teachers in the system, and it's also about attracting more teachers. So there's step number one. We need to significantly improve our paying conditions to attract more teachers and keep more teachers. And then we need to make sure that the funding that we should be getting is actually flowing into our schools. Unfortunately, what's happening at the moment is that a lot of parents are making a choice to send their kids to private schools because they believe that under the private system they get a better education. So the fact that schools are underfunded sort of becomes a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy, because the less students you're coming into a school, that's the less funding you get for your school. So that needs to change. We need to have, you know, public education as the first choice that parents make. And they'll be making that choice if schools are properly funded.
Just to give you an opportunity to actually tell people why public schooling is so important.
Well, it's important that we educate the population, and it's important that people are critical thinkers and that they exist in a democracy, and we can make those choices and we educate everyone properly. I mean, I think that's really, really important. It's about equity. You know, why should a postcode determine the quality of the school that you actually attend? I mean, it's an outrageous proposition. And it's really important that everyone, you know, gets that opportunity and actually learns about the world that they're actually living in at the moment. And I think, you know, it's crucial that we do this.
It's interesting because it was pointed out to me that the public school system that was set up in Victoria was very early in the piece. It was in the 19th century, and it was a groundbreaking distribution of schooling across the state to everybody. And when the politician who was involved in making that happen died, there were people lining the streets of Melbourne to follow his hearse. That's how important it was to the people at that time.
Yeah, and you also have to understand that the demand for public education was a working class demand and a union demand. You go to Trades Hall, you can see how important the unions were as setting up the cultural institutions like the hospitals, like the schools, like RMIT, etc. So this is something that, you know, it's a cultural asset, and we need to make sure we maintain it rather than the situation where we're pitting the community against each other with whether you're going to send your kids to a private or public school. That should be happening. As I said, schools should be properly funded. So, you know, every student gets the best deal that they can. Like, I'd love what we've got in Finland, where it's just government schools. You send your kid to the local government school, and that's it. If there's a problem with the school, you get involved in the school council and you fix it up.
One of the things, one of the reasons for why we were having this chat is because there's been a rally called for Wednesday, November the 12th, outside Anthony Cambine's MP's office at 149 Burgundy Street.
Yeah, that's right. That's at 4:30. Now, that's also, it's on the bus route of 5:13, 5:14, 5:46 and 9:03.
it's also just around the corner from Oldenburg Station. Really, really important that people turn up. And it's really important that your listeners turn up, you know, the progressive leaders in the community turn up and get behind our struggle. We're $2.4 billion delay in funding. Now, the government's not going to give that up without some sort of, you know, real community support. So we need to build the streets, we need to build the halls, we need to have public meetings. It's a social justice issue. Taking $2.4 billion out of working class communities is a social justice issue, and we really need the community, you know, to get behind actions that we actually take. If people want to keep in contact with what the AU is doing, I sort of encourage people to have a look at the AU Facebook page to keep up to date. If there's parents out here listening, please get involved in your local school council. Reach out to the local AU rep at your school, have a talk to them, find out what the issues are. That's really, really important.
Thanks for talking to us this morning.
No worries. Thank you.
And that was Daryl Croke. He's the AEU, the Australian Education Union regional rep for that area. And he's telling people about a rally protesting the delay in funding of $2.4 billion for public schools in Victoria. There's going to be a rally outside Anthony Carbine MP's office, 149 Burgundy Street, Heidelberg, 4:30 p.m. on Wednesday. And as Daryl said, there's the train, there's the buses, there's ways of getting there, and they would love all of us to be there.
And now a rapid fire events calendar till the next time we see you next Saturday. Get your pens and paper out. Saturday today, November 8th at 2 p.m. outside of Sarah Whitty's office, 142 Johnson Street. There's a rally to stop the government from cutting co-health. Tomorrow, later today, there's Palestine National Day at Fed Square with the whole program from 2 p.m. till 10 p.m. Then tomorrow, Sunday, November 9th at 12 noon at the State Library, there's a rally in solidarity with Sudan, Justice for El Fashir. On Tuesday, make sure you come down to Trades Hall, Solidarity Hall, at 6:30 for the inaugural Gaetano Greco Memorial Symposium on Gramsci's Contemporary Relevance. On Thursday, there's the Palestinian Film Festival special screening of Put Your Soul on Your Hand and Walk. And then next Saturday, you can register now for the Craigieburn event, the 15th of November, the Big Ride for Palestine. Just go on APAN to find out more.
And coming up next is Asia Pacific Currents. Thanks for your company.
Se acabó, la paciencia se acabó, se acabó, se acabó, se acabó, se acabó, ya se me acabó, patrón. Explotaste a mis abuelos, a mis padres y ahora a mí. Pero ya se acabó, te juro que se acabó, se acabó, se acabó, se acabó, se acabó, la paciencia se acabó. Por la buena, por la mala, por la mala, por la buena, por la buena, por la mala, por la mala, por la buena, por la buena, por la mala. Tomaremos el poder y usted dejará el poder, burgués, que sí, tomaremos el poder. Y que viva el mar, y que viva el mar,
¡viva!
Y que viva el mar, y que viva el mar. Y los lacandones, y los lacandones, y los lacandones, y los lacandones. Vivan las Fuerzas Armadas de Liberación, vivan las Fuerzas Armadas de Liberación.
fuerza del pueblo. Cuidado, cuidadito. Se acabó, se acabó. Muchacho, ya se acabó. Se acabó,
se acabó,
se acabó,
se acabó.
La paciencia se acabó. Cuando este gobierno caiga, acoruemos de cantar. De la feroz dictadura, mira tú lo que quedó. Pero ya se acabó.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.